This is March 11th, 2018, and I'm going to talk this morning about non-traditional forms, mutations of the Dharma, of Buddhism. I alluded to this in last week's Teisho, that I would, this is related somewhat to last week's Teisho. A non-traditional forms of the Dharma that are Western mutations, and what we have to be aware of in adopting those. Probably the one of the most popular or obvious kinds is what's now being called secular Buddhism. There's an article from an issue of Tricycle. Tricycle is one of the three national Buddhist quarterly magazines. This is from spring of last year. And William Parsons, talks about this phrase, spiritual but not religious. And this I'm trying to just pluck out a few things from this article to talk about secular Buddhism. It's being, I think, Stephen Batchelor is the most prominent proponent of secular Buddhism. The title originated, this title, Spiritual But Not Religious, originated in a 1990 Gallup poll where they gave people that as an option of how they might identify themselves. It became known by the acronym SBNR, Spiritual But Not Religious. And this article is called SBNR, Past and Present, by this William Parsons. And just to say a little bit more about it, it's means being not affiliated with any institutional religion. To say I'm spiritual suggests an openness to religious wisdom, though. The statement can also be ascribed, he says, to those who canvass multiple traditions, mining their spiritual wisdom and practice not for dry doctrine, but for the juice of a peak experience. He says the spiritual but not religious champion individualism, free creative choice and expression, egalitarianism, a psychological / therapeutic approach to spiritual growth, and a seeker / quester / consumer mentality. He cites the research of another person, Kaya Oakes, who encountered many more people who dip in and out of various Buddhist traditions than people who actually identify as Buddhists. He traces what might also be called unchurched spirituality, the roots in our own country, Whitman, Thoreau, Emerson, and others. And also that the 12-step AA program, Alcoholics Anonymous program, it was described repeatedly in the 1950s to the 1970s as being spiritual but not religious. And he goes on to say, here's what we know. The SBNR, seen as a social movement, tends to flourish in democratic and capitalist societies. Thus, one can point to such phenomena as separation of church and state, pluralism, and the rise of film and social media as cultural fertilization, for the growth of SBNR. He says, and of course the triumph of the therapeutic looms large in the evolution of spiritual but not religious. In the work of Freud and other pioneers in the field of psychology, religion was analyzed, deconstructed, and deemed an element of human projection, not divine ordinance. Enter the suspicion that religion only reflects our very human baggage, whether that of class, race, gender, or sexuality. And then Carl Jung proposed that religion was not outside us in institutions, but inside, in the very deepest part of our conscious, of our unconscious. I'm just giving a quick overview here of this idea of spiritual but not religious, which I'm sure some people who are hearing this is how they identify. And then he says, finally, there's the academy itself, whose secular orientation has certainly contributed to the growth of SBNR. When you take a college course on religion, you agree to hold religion up as an object of critical scrutiny. Indeed, after students read Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, Foucault, and others, it becomes more difficult for them to take institutional religion as it is presented without a large dose of salt. So that's a growing thing. That's just Buddhism, but generally in our country, people identifying as spiritual but not religious. In a poll not long ago, about 20% U.S. adults identify as being spiritual but not religious. Now, that's sort of the background of the main article I'm going to be reading from, which is about how... Well, I'll read the title. What's at stake as the Dharma goes modern? An exploration of the background assumptions of the modern age and the unique challenges they present. This is from also from Tricycle Magazine in the fall of 2012, so five years ago or so. And this is by Linda Human, Heuman. Don't know how she would spell it. She's a freelance journalist based in Providence, Rhode Island. So she may pronounce it differently, but she can't object to being called human. So there's a big lead up in this article, big kind of preface to it. She starts, as usual, as journalists usually do, going from the particular and then moves from there into the general. She was at a Mind and Life, one of these annual conferences at the Garrison Institute overlooking the Hudson River. I went to one of those, but it's about cutting-edge advances in brain science research, medicine, and psychology. And she had a chance to ask a question. She went to the microphone and said this: given the depth of suffering in samsara and the possibility of a solution to it, given that the very texts we study outline a path to that solution, given that we have a realized master right here who is, we believe, capable of leading us on that path to that solution, she's referring to her Tibetan Lama was there, why would we devote our precious human lives to exploring whether meditation can lower blood pressure? A provocative question. She knew it would be. She spends a couple paragraphs describing the looks of confusion by all the other participants and indignation and other things. But it is, it's a good question. And this then becomes her reflections on what is, she says, an often overlooked and important difference between Buddhism as it has been traditionally practiced and Buddhism as it is practiced in the West today. And the article, if I can just sort of sum it up, the main theme of it, and I'm doing that because it's a dense article. I had to reread it twice to really feel I had a grasp of her point. And for people who are hearing it read aloud, it would be even more challenging. And so that's my concern, is that whether I can convey her concerns, her points, without it getting too dense with conceptual expressions. Basically, she's saying, and I would agree, that our culture, whatever culture we're in, east, west, wherever, determines how we see the Dharma. This culture we grow up in, the context, if you will, is like a filter or a template through which we see Buddhism or the Dharma, and that we need to recognize that we need to be aware that we're seeing it through our own filter in order to see the true Dharma or reality, things as they are. Here's what I'll what I've marked. I'm skipping. It's a fairly long article, but as usual, I'm just going to read bits of it. She says the experience of being a modern Western Buddhist. She, and by the way, she's a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner. The experience of being a modern Western Buddhist is different from the experience of all previous Buddhists in one crucial respect. We are contending with a radically different environment of faith. What has been off our radar, for the most part, is an appreciation of the very different background of assumptions within which belief itself is construed. The difference has been overlooked, not because it is unimportant, but because it is hard to see. I think of that old saying, a fish doesn't know it's in water. And part of becoming aware, part of growing awareness that happens through long practice in Zen is the challenge of becoming aware of what's hard to be aware of our, again, our filters through which we see reality or the Dharma. She says, for the first time in history, to suggest today in some Buddhist circles that the purpose of Buddhism is exactly what the traditional texts tell us it is, that's in all in italics, which is to say that it is concerned with the transcendent, can be to come across sounding like a rube or to meet with condescension. And then she brings up the whole matter of samsara, the cycle of birth and suffering and death and rebirth. Traditionally, the motivation for practice was to transcend that cycle or to help others to do so. And she makes the point that happiness, which is so hugely important to most Americans and has been studied in a million studies. She says that while the practice of Dharma may and often does bring some comfort, enjoyment, and even happiness in this life, the seeking of these states has always been the very definition of what is not Dharma practice. And she says, we seek these naturally, no practice required. She's really, I really respect what these points she's bringing up, because so much of what people are presented with as reasons to practice Zen or another Buddhist tradition is to become happier or have more comfort and enjoyment, or in mindfulness, the mindfulness craze now is more of these scientific medical things of lowering blood pressure and your pulse and heart rate and so forth. And she's being very, quite a radical reminder of that this, yes, wonderful, who wouldn't want those things? And yes, they come as a byproduct of practice. But as long as we are grasping to just improve our samsaric existence, then we're missing really the core point, purpose of Dharma practice. She says, in entering modernity, Buddhism has crossed a boundary of a nature entirely different from any geographical, linguistic, and cultural barriers it has navigated historically. Buddhism has entered a secular age, and that's not just new soil. It's a whole new ecosystem. Now, I think you all know, I've mentioned at yesterday's workshop, as I do at every workshop, be very clear, we don't care what people, how they identify or don't identify, if they want to sit here. You certainly don't have to consider yourself a Buddhist. We welcome anyone joining us here in our sitting. So let's be clear about that. She says, our secular age is marked off from the earlier period of religious life not only by changes in belief, but also, more profoundly, by shifts in the very preconditions of belief, the background within which both belief and disbelief are construed. She says, imagine for a moment living in Europe, so she doesn't even go to Asia, but even in our own Western Europe 500 years ago. How might you have experienced your moral, spiritual, or religious world? What might your sense of self have been like? Religion was then built into the very fabric of social, political, and private life, much as it has been, and in some cases still is, in Asian Buddhist cultures. The existence of God, that is, in Europe, was not a belief you held. It was quite simply the way things were. In this enchanted, in quotation marks, worldview, people experienced an environment permeated with God's presence and with moral forces, including demons and spirits. A world in which power could hang out in objects like statues or relics, and sacred presence could be enacted in ritual, seen, felt, touched, walked toward in a pilgrimage, for example. For such people, there was no distinction between experience and its construal. In other words, in a world where ghosts are real, to see a ghost is to see a ghost, not to believe you see one. I think she brings the in Tibetan Buddhism. I think there's much more emphasis on what many people now would refer to as the superstitious, which I think misses the point, and she would too. So she's particularly addressing, I think, people in her own Tibetan system who might reject these rituals that are so strong in Tibetan Buddhism, much stronger than in Zen. And then she says, this changed in modernity. Our world became disenchanted. This is using the phrase of the sociologist Max Weber. Our world became disenchanted. Cartesian dualism and the rise of science chased the spooks from their haunts out there, in quotation marks, into a newly understood in here. In this newly constituted sense of self, we modern people experience moral forces, both beneficent and demonic, as private, internal happenings, not as facts about our world. Our, quote, natural world is indifferent, value neutral. For the first time in world history, people do not live in meaning. Meaning lives in us. She continues, half a millennium ago, we couldn't have made sense of the world without God. Now it's hard to make sense of it with him. In this new ecosystem of secularism, a new form of spiritual life is flourishing. To recognize it, it helps to note that religious sensibility comes in two types. One type of sensibility, which can be called closed, understands the highest good and deepest sources of meaning to be located within this world. The other sensibility, an open one, seeks connection to the sacred in something beyond. In other words, all modern people living in the secular West share a common immanent frame of reference, but we can live within it either open or closed to the possibility of something beyond. In the history of religious life, this closed kind of religious sensibility is a newcomer. Today, not only can we conceive of doing such a thing, what is she? That's too complicated. I'm not going to keep going with that. Those who seek transcendence in the context of the immanent frame have a brand new disadvantage, one that Dogen or Milarepa never had to overcome. We have to perform a tug of war with ourselves that was never required of our spiritual predecessors. For Milarepa was one of the two or three most famous Tibetan yogi. For Milarepa, to strive for awakening was to throw his weight toward the collective sense of cosmic order into which he was born. We, on the other hand, have to pull against ours. Our conviction can thus be double-headed. Like Dr. Doolittle's push me, pull you, many of us progress on our spiritual path two steps forward, one step back, straining ahead toward our highest spiritual aspirations, drawn back by socially inculcated common sense. We don't have the wind at our back. And maybe this is why it seems to me that it's more uncommon these days than it used to be, even as recently as the 1960s. It's more uncommon these days to hear people come to practice and say that they want to awaken to their true nature. They want to come to enlightenment. There could be different reasons for that, but one might simply be that it just seems so alien. What I've heard people, when I've asked them that, they've said, I don't know what that is. Well, that's true. None of us knows what it is until we experience it. But still, there is a way that people here at the Zen Center used to envision it. It was more of a viable aspiration that was meaningful to people than it has become. I don't want to overdraw this. Still, there are people who want this front and center as from Zen practice, but I think it's become less voiced in any case, that more and more people seem to be willing to settle for just improving their lot. And this gets into the distinction between the psychological and the spiritual, the very important distinction. In the psychological, we're working with what we construe to be the self, our self. We recognize our psychological knots, our emotional issues, and we're looking and working to clean up those things so that when we die, let's say, we'll have a more ordered self, a happier self when we die. Whereas spirituality, or at least Buddhism, steps back and says, well, what about that dying? What about the whole point of being alive and our facing this cycle of existence of death and rebirth and so forth? Two completely different levels. One is working with the self, and the other is trying to see through the self what is beyond it. And when we're actually sitting or doing zazen, we really are at a disadvantage to the degree that we're thinking about ourself. That's the whole problem, and it's easily done when the mind settles in zazen. We see things, we have insights about ourself, and it's all too easy to just go on investigating that and raising questions about the self. But what's so difficult about this practice is to step out of it entirely, unplug any involvement with I, me, or my, to unplug it completely in complete absorption in the practice. This is where this leads to awakening to the whole illusory nature of self and other. Oh, and then here she is picking up on this. I didn't know she was in sync with me, or vice versa. She says, any of these convert Buddhist practitioners might have deeply... by the way, last week we talked about the three strands of Western Buddhism, and one of them was called, could be referred to as the convert Buddhists, which by their definition means most of us. Most of us started off with a different, Western religion. We were raised with a Western religion or no religion at all, and then we came to adopt Buddhism, or at least Zen. Any of these convert Buddhist practitioners might have deeply transforming experiences, but because these experiences will occur against the backdrop of the view of self understood as private, walled off, and interior, and the view of meaning as inhering within the mind, such experiences will then likely be understood as private psychological states, brain states, or states of consciousness, or even as personal achievements. It must then be asked, might not such an approach end up reinforcing and vindicating a self-experience that is a product of secular modernity? Seen in this light, the adaptation of Buddhism to the West has two aspects, On the one hand, there is the rising popularity of a closed sensibility of Dharma practice, one in which we have made a clear break with all previous Buddhist traditions, relocating techniques and teachings from a background context in which they served transcendent goals into one in which they serve immanent ones. On the other hand, there is an open sensibility of Dharma practice in which practitioners navigate a deep incongruity between their practice and how their world is construed, where conviction struggles to plant a foothold for leverage against a strong counterpull of doubt, and in which one must wonder and then ask, are the transcendent experiences of liberation and enlightenment, which are traditionally the core goals of Buddhist life, no longer possible for us? Well, we know they are, but so long as we're dwelling in any notions of gain for the self or self-improvement, then it is closed to us. She continues, if we are to push on the transplant and adapt metaphor for the transmission of the Dharma to the West, we ought to be ever on the alert. And that's the point of this Teisho, is a kind of a warning that especially teachers of the Dharma, but anyone really, we have to be vigilant as to how we are working against ourselves from our basic cultural conditioning. We ought to be ever on alert for another very, very real possibility. We know from evolutionary biology that sometimes a species adapts to a point where it is no longer recognizable as itself, as happened 400 million years ago when the first animals made their way from ocean to land. Swimmers morphed into crawlers, and thus new species emerged. As we reflect on the nature of the transmission to date, we should be asking ourselves some very difficult questions. If we think of the Dharma as a form of spiritual life, has the nature of its adaptation to a secular modernity changed it unrecognizably? Is modern Dharma a new species? If so, in what sense can we then consider our dialogue with tradition authentic or our transmission successful? I've often said, I think maybe in Teisho, most recently maybe in the afterword to our 50th anniversary issue of Zenbo, that we may be distorting the Dharma just without knowing it. Blindly. This whole issue is sort of a broader form of the need to be aware of how we may be blind to our own individual issues. We can look back and see the ways in which over time, those of us who've been practicing a long time, we come to see that what we thought was practice or teaching was not. We've outgrown those misunderstandings, those misconceptions. But then it's only natural that we assume that right now, no matter how long we've been doing this, we still are laboring under some misunderstandings or some misconceptions. And what are those? What are we missing right now? What are the filters in our individually, in our own nature, and more broadly in terms of the Dharma, what are the filters that we don't know are filters, that are filtering things? It's kind of a impossible thing. How That's why they call it the unconscious, because it's unconscious. We don't know what we don't know. But we don't have to know in any kind of ordinary discursive sense either. And that's where Zen offers so much. The question is, how can we know the Dharma if we're using the conceptual mind? How can we know what is beyond this conceptual mind as long as we're using the conceptual mind? Well, actually, we do have our own contributions to this. It's called science and research. And I'm going to turn to a book, one of my all-time favorite books. This is called The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. And it's based on research. There's a lot of studies that the author Richard Nisbet cites, and it's by virtue of those studies. That's a Western scientific evidentiary approach. It's those very studies that have revealed these big differences in between Asians and Westerners that help us be on the alert for ways in which we are misunderstanding the Dharma. So, a few things here. This is some summaries of things he reports. Easterners attend more to environments, and Westerners attend more to objects. And Easterners being more likely to detect relationships among events than Westerners. There's a difference in basic assumptions about the composition of the world, with Easterners seeing substances where Westerners see objects. Westerners believing in controllability more than Easterners. Westerners seeing stability where Easterners see change. Westerners focusing on objects and Easterners casting a broader net to include the environment. Westerners preferring categories and Easterners being more likely to emphasize relationships. Easterners more inclined to seek the middle way when confronted with apparent contradiction, and Westerners being more inclined to insist on the correctness of one belief versus another. And then going back to the nature of the self, he says the Western style self is virtually a figment of the imagination to the East Asian. Easterners feel embedded in their in-groups and distant from their out-groups. Westerners feel relatively detached from their in-groups and tend not to make as great distinctions between in-group and out-group. In other words, Westerners, especially Americans, tend to identify with the self individualistically, whereas East Asians tend to identify with their group. In Chinese, listen to this, in Chinese there is no word for individualism. The closest one can come is the word for selfishness. A straightforward question among us North Americans will be, if you were to say, tell me about yourself, North Americans will tell you about their personality traits or role categories. The Chinese, Japanese, and Korean self, on the other hand, very much depends on context. So, for example, their answers might be, I am serious at work. I am fun-loving with my friends. Americans report themselves to be more unique than they really are. And today we even have the phrase, very unique. Where we go from there. Just a few more things here. The West-East distinction between relatively independent and relatively interdependent societies. So in the West, insistence on freedom of individual action versus a preference for collective action. The Western desire for individual distinctiveness versus a preference for blending harmoniously with the group. And the Western preference for egalitarianism and achieved status versus acceptance of hierarchy and ascribed status. One of the biggest differences that I've noticed ever since spending a short time in Japan was the whole notion of morality, how different it is in West and East. The Western belief that the rules governing proper behavior should be universal versus a preference for particularistic approaches that take into account the context and the nature of the relationships involved. I've mentioned this in Teisho about the precepts, where we have to consider, or certainly they would in Asia, and there's value to it, with all the precepts, consider the time, the place, the position, relative position of the parties involved, and the degree, and not rigid ideas. Westerners prefer to live by abstract principles and like to believe these principles are applicable to everyone. To set aside universal rules in order to accommodate particular cases seems immoral to the Westerner. To insist on the same rules for every case can seem at best obtuse to the Easterner and rigid and at worst cruel. This, I think, is one of the ways in which the Asian teachers have gotten into trouble with the precepts, with misconduct, is they are more likely to think that as teachers, they're special case. They can do things because of their position. Enough of those particular East-West differences. I'll to resume and finish with this article by Linda Heumann. Certainly it is true that throughout history Buddhism has always changed and adapted as it has moved from one culture to another. And we too, of course, have to make the Dharma suit our culture, adapt it in a way that is authentic and relevant to our lives. We've worked hard to equalize institutional hierarchies and address women's rights, for example. But Western converts have also used this justification to, quote, update versions, to omit or reinterpret doctrines that seem supernatural, like rebirth or karma, liberation or enlightenment, to downplay modes of knowing outside the bounds of instrumental reason, such as symbols and myths, and to discard practices that seem adventitious, that is, acquired, like rituals. Here is why it is important to appreciate that there is more to Buddhism than a set of beliefs or tenets, and to understand that beliefs are rooted within a context of implicit background assumptions that gives them sense, meaning, and force. If we fail to recognize the existence and importance of background context, we will consequently fail to see what is unprecedented about the transmission of Buddhism to the West. So just a comment about that. Yes, I've also said this many, many, many times in Taisho, that our job is to adapt the essence of the Dharma to our own forms, our own culture. Of course, we have to do that. But this is where it gets so tricky, is to not go too far, throw out the baby with the bathwater. So in our center, the Rochester Zen Center, I think there are probably some more Japanese-oriented centers that would find fault with us for not eating with chopsticks, as they do. Or where we haven't retained the Japanese words for, let's say, instruments that we play, or positions, staff positions. And who knows, there's no right or wrong to that. That's the way Roshi Kapil always felt strongly. We have to, if we're going to have the Dharma take root, we have to find suitable Western adaptations. But then without, for example, just dismissing rebirth as something that's just old and superstitious. How do we know? How do we know we're going to, when we die, that's the end, that we won't be reborn? I don't know. So it's one thing to not buy it. Okay, fair enough. Doesn't square with scientific empiricism. You can't prove rebirth, but it's a very different thing to reject it as impossible. So over and over again, we're left on this razor's edge where we can't say it one way, we can't say it the other way. And what does that come down to in Zen? It comes down to not knowing. The most famous words in Zen, I don't know. But we don't need to know to practice this simple practice of Zazen, of detaching from thoughts, looking into the mind. We don't need to know these things. That's why in Zen, the whole issue of rebirth is sort of a peripheral one, unlike in Tibetan Buddhism, which our author here is part of. In Zen, it's what is right here, present before us, what is called for, how we need to respond to help others that matters, not past or future lifetimes. And then her kind of final point. The point here is not that a traditional Asian worldview is right and ours is wrong, but that our secular and materialist convictions block us in certain critical ways from participating in what has always constituted a Buddhist form of life. Much of the meaning of a religion is conveyed in its symbols, rituals, and myths. Consider how our privileging of rational knowing gets in our way. Yeah, this is what a lot of beginners have to contend with, as I did. In the beginning, the bowing, the Buddha figures, the prostrations, the chanting, all can seem just alien, and there comes, we have to face, if you're going to sit at home alone, then there's no issue. You just do what you want and leave out all the devotional side. But if you're going to sit here with others, then there are some elements of the devotional, these very things I just mentioned. Can you give it a try and see if, you know, you can, fake it till you make it. and you will make it. It will grow on you. Or we grow into it and we come to see experientially the wisdom of doing these ritual things. That's all the time we have. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the parade, endless blind passion. I bow to the uproot, dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of